So today I'm going to be talking to you all about studying behavior and biology relationships, actually trying to connect the body, the brain, and the mind together through looking at the study of behavior endocrinology. So like psychology, behavior endocrinology has a short history and a long past. The modern era of behavior endocrinology began with the publication of the book Hormones and Behavior in 1948, but certainly aspects of hormone and behavior relationships have been recognized for ages. And you can see on this slide, I have a quote from Aristotle from about 350 BC, where he says, "The case is the same for men. If you mutilate them in boyhood, the later growing hair never comes and the voice never changes but remains high-pitched. If they be mutilated in early manhood, the late growths of hair quit them except the growth on the groin, and that diminishes but does not entirely depart." And, of course, Aristotle is speaking of the behavioral and bodily effects of the removal of the testes. And, of course, now in the modern era, we understand that the testes produce testosterone, which affects sexual behavior, aggressiveness, territoriality, hibernation, migration, as well as the growth of bodily hair and sexual characteristics. The picture that you see here is an example of a eunuch during the last imperial court in 1949. This is an individual who was castrated in order to allow him to have a beautiful singing voice. So certainly, culturally, we've used our understanding of hormone and biology behavior relationships to emphasize certain traits that are culturally interesting or things that behaviors that people want to have. So the endocrine system is a little different from the nervous system. It's a more of a broadcast system. It results in a slower response. So you might have a hormone that's released, but it takes quite a bit longer for that hormone to have an effect on both biology and behavior of an individual. And also it takes a longer period of time for the effect of that hormone to be extinguished because the hormone is released into the bloodstream, and it takes a long time for that to be taken up by the body. You can think of neural transmission like traveling on a train. You can travel on it as long as the destination and the point of origin are connected by the tracks. Whereas a hormone is like a car. There are many more destinations, and you can have an effect on the body wherever the blood goes, which is pretty much everywhere. You can also think about the nervous system and contrasting it with the endocrine system, that a signal happens in milliseconds. So you can see that they're opposing systems in some ways that work together to integrate biology and behavior. And this slide, I should just mention, are sort of the, as we just talked about, hormones acting sort of like cars that you can travel all around the body wherever the blood goes. We have several different levels of mediation. So you can have hormones working within a cell, all the way up to hormones acting within the environment, where, for example, a pheromone would be released to affect another organism. Okay. This is a diagram of one of the major centers of hormone production in the body. The top part is the hypothalamus, and the bottom part is the pituitary. There are many glands all over the body that secrete hormones, but this is sort of considered the master gland, or the two master glands that control most of what happens in your other glands and the endocrine system. And we'll be talking about it a little more later, but certainly you could study, if you were interested in this, each lobe of the hypothalamus, this particular hormones that are released from the pituitary. There's just an infinite level of detail. Okay, so there are some major take-home ideas that I would like you all to get from this lecture about behavior endocrinology and how hormones work in general. And here are the four main points. First, that hormones are chemical messengers produced and released by specialized glands. They are released into the bloodstream, where they travel to act on target organs some distance from their origin. They can operate over greater distance from their origin and with much greater temporal range than neurotransmitters. So you could have a hormone in very small quantities released from the pituitary that's affecting how your ovaries are behaving, for example. And finally, the main take-home message, and this is the main difference between the nervous system and the endocrine system, is that hormones coordinate physiology and behavior of an animal by regulating, integrating, and controlling bodily function. That is, and more specifically, hormones don't cause behavioral changes. They influence the input, integration, and output of information so that under their influence, the organism becomes more or less likely to exhibit a behavior. It's all about probabilities, not direct action. So, for example, with the voluntary nervous system, if you think that you want to move your arm, you do it, and it's very quick. Whereas with the hormones, if you have more testosterone in your system, it makes you more likely to act aggressively. Okay. So there are sort of two aspects to how hormones influence behavior. There are some systems within the body that act without environmental cues. That is, they're maintained, and they act regardless of whether or not the environment is supporting such cycling behavior of hormones. You can call this a species-specific hormone behavior that affects your own personal behavior. So, for example, in this slide, several hormones act together to affect blood glucose levels prior to waking. And that allows you to actually be awake and act during the day. And you can see here that your temperature rises just before waking, your potassium rises, your plasma cortisol, which is a stress hormone we're going to talk about in more detail, is very high. In fact, it's at its peak right before you wake, and growth hormone is at its highest over the night hours. Now these things, the circadian rhythm of these hormones persist whether or not you are in a regular night-day cycle. So you can put someone in a lab, actually most of the experiments on this have been done with animals, with rats and whatnot, where they're just in persistent daylight hours and they still retain these circadian rhythms. Okay. You can also, however, have these systems that are affected directly by environment and things that happen even culturally. So, for example, you'll see on the graph on the right, this is a study that was done where they took testosterone levels from fans watching a World Cup game between Brazil and Italy. And you'll see that after the game, the Brazilian team have won, the Brazilian fans actually exhibited higher testosterone change. That is, so before there were no differences between the two fans from Italy or Brazil, but they exhibited an increase as a result of the game. So you can see that even getting excited or being a part of a cultural event can have an effect on our hormones, which have an effect on our behavior. And this just emphasizes, you can see at the bottom of the screen, the point is that we have this very cyclical, reciprocal relationship between biology, ecology, and behavior, where you have particular systems in your biology that affect your behavior, and these affect your ecology, and so on and so forth, so that it really is a system of systems that worked to create a whole and a behavioral organism that is coherent. Oh, I have one more example I want to mention, and that is, for example, you can see that, and the hormones also work together as a whole unit. So, for example, you have the same hormones that cause egg or sperm maturation also stimulate mating behavior in many species. So these things go together. And you can see that these things happen on a day-to-day basis. So, for example, on the last slide where we talked about circadian rhythms affecting sleep behavior and wake behavior and your energy levels, it can also affect the cyclical mating behavior that can be on a yearly basis or a monthly basis or even a day-to-day basis. Okay, so that was a very brief introduction to the basics of behavior endocrinology, and there's certainly a lot more to learn about. You could learn about, as I said, all the different glands in the system and how they all work. You could look at testosterone, you could look at estrogen, growth hormone. There are certainly many aspects to be explored, and I would suggest that if you're interested on sort of getting a basic background in the endocrine system, that you go to an introductory text. There is an introductory text on the reading list called Introduction to Behavior Endocrinology that is excellent, that I would suggest you go to. In order to illustrate some of these relationships that we've been talking about and dynamics that we've been talking about, I'm going to talk to you today about stress and development. And the reason I'm choosing stress is because it's something that we as educators are very interested in with our children, and it's also something that's very easily studied in children, and I'll explain why in a few moments. Okay. So I think it's very easy to think about stress as being a bad thing. We always think about, you know, I have a test coming up and I feel very stressed out, and it's sort of a part of our culture, the way we talk about things, how we're feeling in a negative way. But when behavior endocrinologists talk about stress, it's anything that affects the stress system in the body. And these can be positive stressors as well. So here's a negative stress, job stress. But certainly if you're skydiving, that will cause an elevation in your stress level. If you're running, it's a stress on your body and causes that system to be aroused. And the evolutionary sort of old example that you could use is if you're in a threat situation where, for example, here we have the lion. So it's better to think about it not as a negative thing, but as sort of a system that is responsible for arousal in your body. So when your stress system is activated, it acts to increase the immediate availability of energy in your body, increase oxygen intake, to inhibit growth, digestion, immune function, reproductive function, and pain perception, increase blood flow to important fight-flight areas, and to enhance your memory and performance. And these are all things designed to sort of help you survive in the presence of a threat or something that is causing you to have stress on your system. So the stress system basically has there are sort of two halves to the stress system. You have the nervous system, which acts sort of as a very quick response system to threats. So if you're in a threatening situation, if you jump out of an airplane, if you're feeling stressed about a test that's coming up, your immediate reaction, that sort of goose pimply heart rate increase reaction, is as a result of the activation of your sympathetic nervous system. This system responds to fight, flight, fright, and sex. It's principally, the neurotransmitters that are principally involved in it are epinephrine, which comes from your adrenal glands, and norepinephrine everywhere else in your body and in your brain. It responds to short-term acute stresses, so it's that immediate response. You can see here on the right-hand side, I have a picture of a neuron and then an actual diagram of a neuron, just to give you a sense and to remind you that this is the nervous system part of the stress response. Okay. And here's another diagram that sort of breaks apart the pieces of the nervous system. So you can think that this is really a body response. It comes from your brain and your spinal cord, but it's all over, your nervous system is all over your body. We tend to talk about the brain like it's just this sort of disembodied in a bucket kind of thing, but really your nervous system innervates everywhere. And here we have the sympathetic nervous system illustrated next to the parasympathetic nervous system. This is, you can think of these two aspects of the autonomic nervous system as being in opposition to each other. One controls the stress response and one acts in opposition to that to sort of calm you and do all of the things that you do when you're in a relaxed state. So things like grow, things like digestion, having a slow heartbeat, things like salivation, things that you don't need to do if you're in a stressful situation. And you'll see on the left-hand side, the sympathetic nervous system, it inhibits everything that you don't need to sort of fight, flight, fright, or sex, but increases everything that you do need. So anything that would help you increase energy to your system, that's what the sympathetic nervous system does. So like accelerating your heartbeat, inhibiting digestion, they're basically in opposition to each other. Okay. Then we have the endocrine system, which acts in a more long-term way. So when your sympathetic nervous system reacts, if it stays agitated or elevated for a long enough period of time, usually on the order of 10 or 15 minutes, your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, your HPA system, will become activated. And usually you see elevations in the system in about 20 minutes. You can actually measure there's enough hormone in your system if you're agitated aroused for a long enough period of time to actually see the hormones in your system, either in your blood or in your saliva. In these diagrams, you see all the aspects of the HPA system. The diagram on the left sort of gives you a more bodily representation of the aspects of the HPA system, and the diagram on the right sort of shows you how these different hormones affect each other. The details here aren't too important, it's just how the system acts. So I'm going to go through it very, very quickly for you here. Basically what happens is when you become aroused for a longer period of time, the hypothalamus becomes activated to release a hormone called CRF. Or CRH, corticotropin releasing factor or hormone. This hormone causes the pituitary to release a hormone called ACTH. The more CRH you have, the more ACTH you have. ACTH is released into the bloodstream, and this affects the adrenal gland. The adrenal gland causes the ACTH affecting the adrenal gland causes the release of cortisol, which is the end product of the stress system. Cortisol is both a stress hormone and an anti-stress hormone. This is really important. Cortisol in your body allows for the release of glucose into the bloodstream to help you with your fight or flight response. But it also inhibits the upper levels of the HPA system. So the more cortisol you have in your system, it's telling the hypothalamus, shut down, don't make any more CRH, don't make any more ACTH. There's enough, we're aroused enough. So it's controlling your stress system while also helping your body to respond to stress. Okay. Now this picture is just to help you get a sense of how incredibly And you think about how incredibly influential your stress system is, and yet the system is incredibly efficient and small. You're basically talking about a tiny little gland, the pituitary gland. You can see it's labeled in this diagram, is affecting how your entire body responds to any threatening situation. It's incredibly small. It's at the base of the brain behind the eyes. And it releases an incredibly small amount of hormone, which affects your entire body. So this is an evolutionarily old system that's in place to help us survive. Okay. So how does cortisol behave? First of all, I should mention that cortisol is the most studied of all the hormones, or it's one of the most studied of all the hormones. And the reason why is because it's easy to study. It actually is one of the only hormones that you can measure in a person's saliva, which makes it very easy to collect, and it makes it easy to collect in ecologically valid contexts. So you can go into a school to collect saliva. You can be at a wrestling match to collect saliva. And it's quite non-invasive, and it's easy to get people to agree. There's no needles, there's no blood draws. So some of the reason why there's so much written about this is because it's so easy to study. And that actually has caused a problem for this literature in some ways, because in order to study the sort of upper level hormones that affect the release of cortisol, like ACTH or CRH, you have to get blood draws or cerebral spinal fluid. And there are situations where you see the behavior of cortisol act in one way, but you can't really assume that that CRH or ACTH is behaving in the way that you would expect. So it might be that cortisol, for example, becomes deregulated and is high, indiscriminate of the levels of CRH and ACTH. In fact, I'm going to explain to you a situation where that becomes the case. But before we get to that, I want to talk about the basics of cortisol behavior. Now, as you can see on this chart, there are basically two ways that you can think about measuring and studying cortisol. The first way is to think about it in reaction to a particular or acute stress response. That is, I have a stressor affect me, like jumping out of an airplane, and that affects my cortisol levels within 20 minutes or so. And you can see on this first, the chart on the top, this was a study that was done to see the effects of cortisol in response to a stressor, which was jumping out of an airplane. And you can see on the first jump, the dark bars represent the stress day, so those are on jump days. They measured in the same people at the same time of day. On a non-jump day, those are the white bars. And you can see that, in fact, there is a significantly higher level of cortisol on the jump days in all three cases. Now, what's interesting about this chart is you can see that the black bars become smaller from day to day to day. And this illustrates another aspect of the stress system, and that is if you encounter a stress, you have a response to it, you encounter the stress again, as long as you were able to handle that stress in the past, your response, your hormone response, your behavior response will be less the second time. This is called habituation. So that's one way that you can study the stress response. The second way, and this is very important, is that the cortisol is one of those circadian rhythm hormones that we talked about earlier in the lecture. This hormone acts throughout the day to help us have enough glucose, basically, in our system to be awake and to be behaving in the world. So you can see in the chart on the bottom, just to orient you, the very middle of the chart where it says 8 o'clock is first thing, where it says 8 o'clock is basically first thing in the morning. Oh, is that right? Yep, that's right, I'm sorry. So you can see that as the day progresses, your cortisol levels go down. These are adults, I should say. They go down throughout the day. And then over the night, they rise and rise and rise and rise and rise. And the reason for that is because overnight, you're fasting. You don't have enough sugar in your body just from eating in order to be able to stay alive. So your rising cortisol levels cause glucose to be extracted so that you can make it through the night into the next morning. And the second line, you can see there are two lines here. And actually, we have the normal individuals and the depressed individuals on the top. This is one of the most major findings in the cortisol literature among adults. And that is that individuals who are depressed have sort of this high, flat, cortisol levels over the day as compared to normal controls. That is, they don't typically show as exaggerated a circadian pattern, and their levels are higher. And we're going to get into this in a few minutes, but basically the idea is that cortisol levels and your stress system can become socially regulated. So if you're having a behavioral, a sort of long-term behavioral problem or emotional problem, psychological problem, that can affect how your stress system behaves. Okay. So, recently there's been a lot of work done on development and the stress system, mostly because it's easy to study, but also because it's really interesting. We want to understand how our children experience stress and how that affects their performance in school, how that affects their behavior with their parents. And this is really, it's really important because if someone has exaggerated cortisol levels, cortisol can actually act as a neurotoxin. So it's really important that we understand the behavior of this system and be able to understand it in our children as well. This is a chart of a study that was done by Megan Gunner. Megan Gunner is pretty much the premier person doing work in this area right now. And I would suggest that if you're interested in looking at development and stress, that you do a search on her name, because she's pretty much attached to all the major papers on this, every study that's been done. So this is a study that she did looking at children's, babies actually, cortisol response to being in an exam. And you can see that even at less than 11 weeks, these children show an exaggerated cortisol response to the stress, which is the exam. The cortisol levels are in the black bar. The white bar in the middle is the proportion of fussing, and the bar that has the lines on it is the proportion of crying. So you can see that these infants are having their exam by their doctor. They show elevated cortisol and also elevated fussing and also elevated crying. But you can see that after 11 weeks that these babies have still show the fussing and the crying, but they show their stress response has become habituated to this experience. So you'll see that the black bar is very small, even though they're still exhibiting behavior distress. And the idea here is that, or the way this has been interpreted, is that the babies now know or have a sense of how to get the response they need from their parent or from their doctor so that they don't have to have the stress response, which can be a negative thing. Remember, we talked about it being a neurotoxin, elevating everything in your body. In this case, they're sort of giving the exaggerated response, they're getting the response they need, and their cortisol levels don't rise. And I should say also about that chart that I think it really speaks to how evolutionarily old the system is. It's in place basically at birth, all the evidence would suggest that, where you can have elevated levels in response to an acute stress, and that stress can be, that those levels can become habituated with exposure to stressors that are the same. So this is really, it's the same behavior of the system that you would expect in an adult, really. But there are things about the stress system that is different for small children and developing children. And in fact, the system on a whole shows a developmental trajectory among normal children. So we just talked about how over the day, cortisol in normal adults and adolescents show the circadian rhythm, where your highest levels are in the morning because they've been rising over the course of the night, and they decrease over the course of the day. Well, infants, when they're born, actually don't show this circadian rhythm. And the thought is that it may be because they haven't developed any sort of regular sleeping patterns yet. So that system hasn't become concretized yet. And you can see on this chart, this basically shows the progression of how salivary cortisol levels change from the course of the morning to the afternoon. So each of those bars represents the difference for that age child between their morning and their afternoon. These are averages, I should say. So you can see very early on, between 2 months and 12 months or 11 months, that these children do show some differences in the direction you would expect, but actually they're not significant. They're not significantly different from each other, the differences between morning and afternoon. So the rhythm is there for the population, really, but for individuals, there's a lot of variation, so we don't really find a significant effect. Between 12 months and through almost 36 months, you can see that the difference between the morning and afternoon cortisol becomes very small. You can see the bars get very close to zero. Nobody is entirely sure why this happens, but children, you can think about this, that children basically enter a hyporesponsive period. And the hypothesis is that these children, that normal children, during this period of time are facing a lot of stressors. They're left alone more by their caretaker with someone that is not their primary caregiver. They are starting to be in peer situations, which can be very stressful when you're first starting to make friends and interact with others. Everything is sort of new. And if you remember, we talked about that cortisol can act as a neurotoxin. So it's been hypothesized that this period is really a protective, this hyperresponsive period, it's protected, it may be genetically sort of influenced and pre-wired, if you will, to happen, that these children will enter this period. So the kids still fuss, they react to new stressors, but their cortisol doesn't react. And then you can see by this chart that by 36 months, and certainly by 48 months and on, they really develop the sort of normal adult circadian pattern that you would expect. Okay. So, one of the things that's come out of this literature that's very interesting is that in addition to these developmental changes that we expect to see, and this normal habituation cortisol reactive pattern that we see in adults and children, we've also found that some of these patterns seem to be socially regulated. So if you entering the hyporesponsive period, for example, is dependent on if you have a sensitive and responsive caregiver, if you're securely attached. So when I showed you this graph prior, and we talked about this hyporesponsive period, this is just for children who are securely attached, sort of normative children. So when a child has a caregiver who is not responsive, and in the worst case who is maltreated, the child does not develop an expectation that they'll be taken care of, or that their needs will be met when they have a stress response. So in fact, a lot of these children, and these effects have been found across many studies now, it's a very robust finding, that they in fact never enter this middle hyporesponsive period. They continue to exhibit the circadian rhythm, and in fact their levels are higher over the entire course of the day as compared to the these other securely attached children, just like the depressed adult effect that we talked about earlier, that is a very robust finding. Okay, but this is actually true, that we just talked about the extreme case example, but these differences in cortisol reactivity and cortisol levels over the day are also true for among children who maybe don't experience the extreme of maltreatment, but maybe find themselves rejected by their peers at school, or who have difficulty relating to adults. So this is a study that, again, was done by Megan Gunner. And here you can see these are children who are in kindergarten. And you can see that what she did was she measured salivary cortisol. There are averages over the day. And what she did was she asked the children, everyone else in the class, to rate the children on their popularity. And what she found was that the children who were rejected had the highest cortisol levels over the course of the day. And this has major implications for these children's health, because cortisol can, as we said, act very negatively on the body, in addition to just causing you to be constantly aroused. She also saw differences among the popular average and neglected children, where the children who were most popular had the lowest cortisol levels over the course of the day. Okay, so we talked a little bit earlier about the effect of being maltreated. And this graph, this is just an example of one of the studies that were done with maltreated children. These children are children who are in kindergarten. And she was looking at, this is a study that was done by Hart and Gunner. And what they did was they looked at the salivary cortisol levels over the course of the day on the lowest conflict days and the highest conflict days. So they just sampled every day for a month, and they also did behavior ratings of how much conflict was in the classroom. And then they took the lowest conflict days and the highest conflict days and looked at the children's cortisol levels. And what they found was that the differences on the lowest conflict days, the maltreated children had higher levels on the lowest conflict days than the comparison group. But on the highest conflict days, they exhibited this lower pattern. So these children are in kindergarten. They're already have already gone past the hyper-responsive period, so you would expect them to exhibit the sort of normative cortisol rise in response to a stressor like having conflict in your classroom. And the comparison group does that. They show sort of elevated levels on that day. But the maltreated children don't show an increase on those days. They have this low cortisol level. And the hypothesis is that these children basically have their system becomes elevated, the rest of their system becomes elevated. They're still more aggressive on the high conflict days. They're still more aroused on the more high conflict days, but their cortisol no longer responds to that. And the idea is that all the way along, they never entered the hyporesponsive period that you would expect. They never had feedback that would allow them to understand from their caregiver that their needs would be met in the context of a threatening situation. So their cortisol, they're constantly in this high reactive state to new stressors because they don't know if they're going to be safe. And what eventually happens is that the whole system becomes deregulated so that the system is still responding, but you no longer have the cortisol reacting to the rest of the system, which causes the system not to be able to shut down. If you remember, cortisol acts as a stress hormone to help you respond to fight or flight, but it also acts to get the stress system under control. So if you don't have that cortisol rise, you're not going to be able to get yourself back under control. And that is, in fact, a hallmark of the behavior of children who have been maltreated. That is, they're in the classroom, they're face a stressful situation, and they can't get themselves back under control. Either they're aggressive, sort of the fight-flight aspect, or the fight aspect of the stress response, or they become completely withdrawn, and you can't pull them out of that, which is the flight aspect of the stress system. So, in summary, there are basically three cortisol patterns that are evident in early childhood, and these patterns seem to be related to primary caregiving. So you have a normative pattern where the child is reactive, shows a normal habituation to repeated stressors, but then becomes hyporesponsive. Then you have this at-risk group of children who show the normative reactive pattern, but then become hyper-responsive. That is, their cortisol levels are higher than the normative children, and they're more reactive, but they haven't sort of gone over the edge to this deregulated state that the maltreated children exhibit, or it's been reported the maltreated children exhibit. And that's, in fact, the last group. These children are deregulated. They're hyper-reactive, then hyporesponsive. So their system gets going, but they can't get it back under control. So this raises a lot of questions. First of all, if we can understand the behavior of this system, and we understand what the system integrates, your social behavior, your memory, your cognition to some degree, what can understanding a child's physiology and these on these dimensions, and in terms of their stress response, what are the effects on these dimensions? So we want to ask those questions and think about them. But also, when a child exhibits a deregulated system, what are the implications of that, and what can that tell us about how we should teach and help children learn in the classroom and in their parent-child relationships in terms of intervention? So one really good example of that is the idea that children who exhibit this deregulated pattern actually look a lot like ADHD children in the classroom. But certainly, given the, now that we understand the underlying physiology, we can understand that that in fact the etiology of these two disorders, which present virtually the same in the classroom, are very different, and that would have implications for how you behave with those children as a teacher in the classroom. But there's a lot of work left to be done here, and certainly some of these findings, especially among the maltreated children, need to be replicated and followed up on. So, thank you.